For years, Richard Perle has wielded enormous influence on American foreign policy. He was Assistant Secretary of Defense during the Reagan administration. But his real influence comes from outside the government. He's one of the intellectual gurus of conservative hardliners. Perle's just written a primer on foreign policy with another Washington insider, David Frum. The book is called An End to Evil. Perle told Steve Paulson that Iraq was just the beginning of the war on terror. Now, he says, Iran is pursuing weapons of mass destruction and its leaders must be removed.
Iran is harboring al-Qaeda people in Iran now. They claim they have them under arrest, incarcerated, but there's lots of evidence to suggest that they are being allowed to operate. The mullahs who run Iran, quite apart from dictating every aspect of the lives of the Iranian people to totalitarian state, are up to their eyeballs in terror. We caught them sending weapons to Palestinian terrorists, for example.
You have a lot of connections to the White House and to the Defense Department. Are high-level people there seriously considering an invasion of Iran?
I don't know that they are. I have no indication that they are, and we're not recommending, David and I are certainly not recommending an invasion of Iran. What we are recommending is that we support those Iranians who want to liberate their country. We think it's a substantial majority of the people of Iran.
What does that mean, to support those people who would want to overthrow the current regime?
Well, at a minimum, it means helping them communicate so they have a window into the outside world and the people of Iran have some sense of what is going on even in their own country. During the Cold War, our broadcasting activities frequently provided the best information that Poles and Czechs and Hungarians and others had about what was going on in their own countries. That's a service we can and should provide to the people of Iran.
But realistically, if you're serious about wanting to remove the current regime in Iran right now, at some point, wouldn't that involve U.S. military action? I mean, is it realistic that it would happen any other way?
The truth is there's a lot we don't know. We don't know whether the Iranian security forces, the Revolutionary Guard, would fire on Iranian citizens, or if they did, whether they would sustain that. We have seen governments change largely without violence. Look at what happened in Georgia just the other day. Shevardnadze stepped down. He didn't want to step down, but the massed opinion in opposition was sufficient. I think you take this step by step.
Now, there's already tremendous anger in the Muslim world against the United States, and I would think that if there is obvious U.S. support to try to overthrow the regime in Iran, that anger would escalate even more, probably rather dramatically. Does that bother you?
Well, I'm not sure it's true. I think there is a lot of sympathy for the plight of the people of Iran, who, of course, are not Arabs. So the Arab world shows less interest in Iran than it does in some other places. I think we have to align ourselves with people who want freedom. And we need to do a better job of explaining that that's who we wish to associate with. And that task is made more difficult by the fact that we are frequently allied with dictatorial regimes. I'm willing to take the risks of whatever negative publicity attaches to our support for people who are trying to free themselves.
But don't you think there is tremendous anger towards this kind of unilateral action by the United States? I mean, isn't that the motivation for protests not only throughout the Middle East but Europe as well?
Well, I think there are a lot of reasons behind the protests. But if the choice is between unilateral action and anger on the one hand, and paralysis and inaction and defenselessness on the other without anger, there's no question what we have to choose.
Now, one of the complaints, the criticisms that a lot of people who opposed the war against Iraq voiced was the morality of preemptive war. Iraq had not attacked us. What do you make of this as a moral issue?
Well, I think it's a practical question and not a moral question, although I'm perfectly happy to defend our Iraq policy on moral as well as practical grounds. I'm sure you would agree, and the people you're referring to would agree, that if we saw a missile being erected on a launcher aimed at the United States and we had the capacity to destroy that missile on its launcher before the countdown, we would be justified in doing that. In fact, we'd be irresponsible and negligent if we didn't do it. That's an act of preemption. It's also an act of self-defense. Do we have to wait until the missile lands on our territory? Now, if we're talking not about a missile on a launch pad that's within our gun sights, but a nuclear warhead that is being fabricated in North Korea, it becomes a more difficult issue. And the question then is, what is the right moment when the requirements of self-defense justify our acting before we are struck? And I think that can only be answered in the specific context of the specific situation. But on moral grounds, it seems to me, if we can protect the lives of our citizens by acting preemptively, the president has an obligation to do that. We're right to do that.
I'm curious about your background and how you came to be a hardliner. Were there any pivotal events, any turning points in your intellectual development that made you what you are today?
Oh, goodness. I suppose I was influenced more than anything else by 11 years working for Scoop Jackson, senator from Washington State. Scoop was a man who detested totalitarianism in all its forms, left, right. He fought the Nazis. He fought the communists. And he believed that properly focused American power could be a tremendous force for good in the world.
Back in the 80s, when you worked with the Reagan administration, you got various nicknames from people who didn't like you. You were called the Prince of Darkness and Darth Vader. What did you make of those kinds of comments?
Well, I can tell you about the Prince of Darkness. That was a case of mistaken identity. And it's a simple story. A reporter from a British newspaper, The Observer, came to Washington, thought he'd do a feature piece about a young Senate staffer. He selected me to write the piece about. And he went about interviewing people who knew me, one of whom happened to be Dennis Healey, who had been Minister of Defense in the UK and who knew my boss, Scoop Jackson. And this reporter interviewed Healey, and Healey said, in Washington, Pearl is known as the Prince of Darkness. Well, he was wrong about that. Nobody'd ever called me the Prince of Darkness. There was someone who was called the Prince of Darkness in Washington then, and that was Bob Novak, the syndicated columnist. It was literally a case of mistaken identity. But it was published that way. And it's even worse now in the Google age, but even then, once you're described in a newspaper article that's widely published, the next guy who writes about you goes and looks at the clips. And so the next guy who wrote about me said, in Washington, he's known as the Prince of Darkness. And that was it. that was there forever.
Well, and then those nicknames stuck. And for years, then, liberals who saw you as kind of this lightning rod, this conservative figure who was always pushing for policies they didn't like, I mean, they would call you Prince of Darkness, Darth Vader. I guess I'm wondering if in some way you kind of wore those names as badges of honor.
Well, I would have preferred to be known by my proper name. But I gave up trying. I once said to a friend of mine, you know, there are all these attributions of almost demonic powers to me. How should I respond to that? And he said, just tell them they don't know the half of it.
Richard Pearl, the co-author with David Frum of the book An End to Evil, How to Win the War on Terror. He spoke with Steve Paulson.